Cancer. It's a word that holds enormous power. For those who have lost loved ones, it carries grief and fear. For those fighting cancer, it brings uncertainty. And for those who haven't faced it yet, it's still a word that makes your heart skip a beat. And here's the truth. As we age, the word only gains more weight. Maybe that's because despite millions of dollars and decades of research, cancer still feels like a mystery to most of us. That's why today we're shining a light on cancer with someone who has dedicated his life to solving the puzzle, Professor David Thomas. He's a global leader in precision oncology, a cancer detective, if you like, who uses genomics to unlock new treatments and the driving force behind Omico, Australia's largest cancer genomics programs. I should add, it's a not-for-profit. His vision, to make personalised cancer treatment the standard of care, available to every patient, not just the lucky few. So today we're going behind the scary headlines, behind the standard get your screening advice. We're asking, what does the future of cancer care really look like? How close are we to beating it? And what could you do to protect yourself and your family? Let's welcome Professor David Thomas.
It's wonderful to be here, Shelley, on your program.
Professor, let's start with cancer and what that word means to you.
Well, cancer is an ancient scourge of mankind, isn't it? It's the term malignancy tells it all. It's something that evokes more than an abstract concept of disease. It's something that we think of as an ancient evil. And perhaps it's a disease which we've become accustomed to. It's become part of our furniture, which is it's a disadvantage in some ways because we don't look at it with fresh eyes very often. We don't think of it as being like COVID-19 or HIV, a problem that emerges from the blue and which we tackle without any preconceptions. Cancer, we've become accustomed to thinking about it as something we have to live with rather than we can tackle, which I think is changing.
Has it been around forever? Is it an ancient disease? I know we're hearing so much more about it now with younger and younger people becoming, I guess, victims of cancer.
Yes, it is ancient. You can find evidence of tumours in mummies, for example. So certainly as far back as we can go, we think that cancer has affected people. And it's a fundamental problem with having complex structures and long lives. Basically, it's a problem of the corruption of our source code, isn't it? The code that defines every part of us from the top of our head down to the tip of our toes is determined by a code that we inherit from our parents. And that code goes bad, unsurprisingly, over a lifetime. And when it goes bad, tumours form because cells grow uncontrollably in their own interest as opposed to serving the interests of the whole, the person themselves. That's essentially the problem of cancer.
It is a word, isn't it, that triggers so many emotions. It's fear, sadness. I know a lot of people feel great anger around this word. And so many people are doing amazing work around the treatment of it. You're diving even deeper than that. Can you tell us about your work?
Well, so first of all, for your audience's benefit, I'm a medical oncologist by training, which means I've looked after cancer patients probably for the best part of 35 years now. As an oncologist for 28 years now. And it's changed a lot in that time, fortunately. We've gone from thinking about cancer as a disease of an organ, anatomy, a breast cancer or a lung cancer or a brain cancer. That's fundamentally about anatomy, to looking down the microscope and seeing these funny little pink and blue patterns that we use to define a lung adenocarcinoma, for example, compared to a lung squamous cell carcinoma. And all of these things have over more than 170 years now shaped the way that we think about and manage those diseases. But what's happened recently, which is the focus of my own work, is that we now have a molecular view of cancer. And Of course, there's nothing about the pinkness and blueness that tells us necessarily how the cancers are going to behave. We can't predict that. We can observe it, and therefore, based on 170 years worth of experience, we can predict what's going to happen with a lung squamous cell carcinoma, for example. But it tells us nothing about what makes that cancer tick. The difference with a molecular view of cancer is that it tells us what makes the cancer tick. It tells us why it happened in many cases, and it tells us what we can do about it. And that's radically transformed our ability to make an impact on patients.
It sounds like extraordinary work, and obviously working in the field and dealing with patients every day, was it your just drive to say there has to be something more, there has to be a different way?
Yes, I'm now old enough to have lived on both sides of the way we think about cancer. I've lived through the change from what it used to be like to where I think we are today. And it's thankfully chalk and cheese. In the old days, we were using drugs that were pretty toxic because we didn't know how to select out cancer cells from non-cancer cells. But over the past 30 years, we've moved to using drugs that specifically target vulnerabilities that are uniquely present in the cancer cell and not present in normal cells in many cases. And what that allows us to do is use drugs that are more potent, that are more selective and more effective ultimately, about six times as effective technically as it was in the 1990s when my career began.
So we should be feeling extremely hopeful and I guess excited that a cure for cancer isn't too far away?
Well, cure is a strong word, but it's on the table for discussion, isn't it? I think the big advance in the use of the word cure probably emerged about a decade ago with a new class of treatments called immunotherapies. Now, immunotherapies essentially harness our own immune systems to fight the cancer. And we've developed drugs that will activate the immune system to do that in some cases. It doesn't work for everybody, but it works for people with melanoma, for example, and it works for people with lung cancer. And many other cancer types over the past 10 years have been shown to respond. The thing about those immunotherapies is that once you switch on the immune system, there are individuals who we would have thought of as incurable maybe 10 years ago, who seem to be disease-free now. And that does point to the idea that these drugs may, if we learn to use them well, may be enough to control a cancer in the same way that, for example, we learned to control HIV and AIDS, turning it from a death sentence into something that people can live full and productive lives with.
So something that used to be, I guess, a one-size-fits-all approach to cancer treatments, the same drugs, the same protocols, regardless of your own biology, and, of course, regardless of where the cancer was in your own body, has now become a much more targeted approach, you're saying, and each individual cancer has a slightly different treatment and approach, and each individual body has a different reaction to that.
Yes, so you've touched on so much in that description, but it's all accurate. So I guess what we do now is we go through the usual process. We take a CT scan of the body and we see where the tumor is. That's anatomy. We look down the light microscope after applying various stains and we see the pinkness and blueness, and that's histology. And what we are moving into is getting sophisticated molecular tests that tell us the unique circuitry that drives each individual cancer. And as you said, that's different from person to person. So only by doing this test can we know what's going on in one person's tumor that might not be relevant to another person's tumor. More importantly, there are drugs now that we can link to the right patient. So if we see a particular change in person A and we have a drug that we can use for that person's cancer, then that person is more likely to respond than person B who doesn't have that change, but the drug won't work. So through the lens, if you like to think of it that way, it's like a lens, like the light microscope itself. Probably the single most important advance over the past 170 years has been the use of these molecular lenses that allowed us to think about cancers completely differently. The other thing that you said was that we all respond differently, our bodies respond differently, and that's also true. There are the genes that we inherit from our parents that come from our mother and our father. determine who we are. I mean, it's obvious that when you look at somebody who's the daughter their mother and daughter resemble each other, but it's because of the genes that they inherit. Those genes that we inherit can also determine our risk for cancer. So that one person may have a very high risk of cancer, another person may have a relatively low risk of having cancer. And we can determine that by studying the genes that we inherit, as opposed to the genes that are present within a tumor itself. These are the genes in the rest of our body, if you'd like. And those genes not only tell us about what your risk of cancer is, but we're beginning to learn that it also tells us how we'll react to certain drugs. So one person may have a very good reaction to a drug, respond very well, and another person with a different genetic makeup may have an adverse reaction to that drug. It's the field of what we call today pharmacogenomics. And that's an area which is going to be very important for the use of medications for patients going forward, but it is just beginning to be integrated into clinical practice.
A quick pause for anyone interested in joining our DNA testing program in partnership with FitGenes, a world-leading genetics company. So many of you have already joined our FitGenes community. So now, for anyone who hasn't, it's your turn. Get to know your genes with us. When you know your genes and your unique genetic breaks, you can do something about it. For us here at the Aging Project, we've learned it's the best first step in our aging well journey. If you'd like to learn more, visit theagingproject.com and join the Fit Genes waitlist. We'll send you all the details so you can get started. So this is where that detective work comes into play for you and your peers, isn't it? It's now piecing that all together and not just saying, right, this is how we're going to do it. I can imagine how frightening it must be to sit in that chair and hear that you have a cancer diagnosis. And then the next question is, where do we go from here?
Yes.
Previously, I'm sure, well, it's obviously seemingly it's very different now, but is this approach available to everybody? Are all oncologists looking down this tunnel?
Well, I think all of us are looking in that direction, but it's certainly not a standard of care. So today in our society, the standard of care is to do anatomy and to do histology down the light microscope, and then we use that information to guide subsequent treatment. But for most cancers, we don't routinely access molecular profiling of the tumor. That's something which is emerging from research and has yet to become mainstream clinical routine daily care. So most of the treatments, most of those approaches and the treatments attendant on those approaches are still accessible primarily through research programs like the ones that we run. But I think it's important that I give the impression that this field is only about 10 or 15 years old, which is very young, and has made incredible advances over that time, so that I think the evidence is building for us to move it out of research and into routine clinical practice so that everybody can access it. I can describe how we provide access to it today and what the limitations of that are, the things that we observe that make us feel that it should become clinical care, but there's a big gap between what we're doing in research and how we change the whole healthcare system.
Right. And is that a monetary reason? Because I would imagine anyone in that seat would say, do whatever you can.
Yes.
If that research is new, I don't care. I'm willing to give it a shot.
Yes. Well, look, you've touched on several things again. So, yes, when a patient sits in front of you as a researcher, the first thing I do is I look at what is known currently, what is the best practice. And sometimes what we're doing will cure the patient with the tools we have today. And in fact, in New South Wales, we have amongst the best survivals from cancer in the world. We have a 70% five-year survival from cancer, which is extraordinary. Back in the 1970s, it was something like 25%, to give you an idea of just how much incredible progress has occurred over that time frame. But we don't cure everybody, and eventually we run out of the recipes that we use in routine practice, and it's then that research kicks in. So, yes, I think the second thing is, this is a good litmus test, really. If it were any of us now, I think the evidence has reached has reached the point where, yes, you would pay for this test because it is likely. In our case, we think it's about 1 in 3 patients who get a molecular profile will identify a good drug target. Not any drug target, but a good drug target that will extend their survival if we can get access to the drug, which typically has to be accessed through clinical trials. It's not a routine care. And programs like ours, which have been generously funded by the government, are still research-based and therefore mean that patients have to travel, they have to sign consents. It's not something that can be provided by any doctor, any oncologist in their rooms to every patient that comes in. We're still only getting to about 1 in 5 cancer patients who would ultimately benefit.
That's tough numbers to absorb, isn't it, if it's not you?
Yes, that's the issue, of course. That's why we're working very hard at the moment in discussions with government to think about mainstreaming. Now, why aren't we doing it immediately is an obvious question for your audience. The reason is, firstly, it's very young. So the evidence has only been around for 10 or 15 years, and medicine isn't designed to be quick in its responsiveness. It's designed to be stable and reassuring, but the corollary of that is that perhaps it's a bit slow moving when progress is being made at such speed these days. The second is it's the leading cause of death in our society. So it means it's a big economic and social impact if we're to fundamentally change the management of cancer. And that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about an incremental change in one cancer type. We're talking about a model of care for the leading cause of death in our society. So it's a big change in a system that's designed to be careful and conservative about the way in which it uses tax dollars. The third thing is, in that 10 or 15 years, we've seen evidence from a patient-centered point of view that it benefits patients. So we can see extension of survival in clinical trials, but we haven't yet had evidence about how it should be integrated into a health system that is paid for by taxpayer dollars. For example, many of the trials that are being used in the US by the Food and Drug Administration for deciding about whether to recommend a treatment, to approve a treatment for a certain indication, those trials don't have any comparator. They're not randomized. And what that means is, while the drugs are clearly effective, you can see tumor shrinking in those studies, what you don't have is survival gains. You don't have measures about how much longer somebody survives by comparison with a group that hasn't received the treatment. And the reason that's a problem is that in our healthcare system, the way in which we decide to invest taxpayer dollars is the dollar cost for the extension of life, of quality adjusted life, technically. So you need that measure of survival gain in order to estimate how much it costs to get that benefit. And if you can't estimate it because the trials haven't been designed that way, it's very hard for healthcare systems that use taxpayer dollars to then compare this new innovation to, for example, vaccines or to health prevention programs, other things that may also extend survival. So effectively, we're in a funny situation where the science is largely clear. And I can say that these things are extending people's lives through research, but actually getting them into the healthcare system needs more than that. We need the evidence to show that this approach, this very significant and large scale approach we need, is worth the dollars in the conventional terms that we've always used to decide whether something is good value for money. And that's where we are today. That's, in a nutshell, the challenge we face today.
Oh, Professor, it's so hard to swallow, isn't it? Because, yes, we have all lived through COVID. And as you say, there was an enormous reaction and, whichever way you want to look at that, and I'm not going to go into that today, but it seemed the country rallied. And we do rally when it comes to cancer. There's so many incredible fundraising organizations out there. There's incredible individuals like, you know, the wonderful Samuel Johnson, yes, doing incredible things with his charity. There's the Breast Cancer Foundation. There's Cancer Council. There's so many ways that we donate on a daily basis. There's so many ways that we get behind these with, you know, the Mother's Day walks and things like that. So that is extra money, obviously, on top of our taxpayer dollars. Is that where this money goes, obviously into individual research for different cancers, or does it all get pulled and to an organisation like yours to push forward?
Well, the answer is yes and no. So you're correct that there are two sources of funding for research for the cutting edge of care that is coming along but is not yet standard of care, and therefore paid for by taxpayer dollars in our healthcare system anyway. Those two sources of funds are medical research funds and philanthropic funds. Now, medical research funds are cyclical and short-term. They're always based around show us that you're going to do X and do it by, say, 3 years. It's not something that is there in perpetuity, can be built upon as a model of care, because the funding is necessarily time-limited. It's not there in perpetuity. And so philanthropy comes in because once you get to the point, the tipping point of knowing intuitively that an approach is good for you, for your family members, for people you care about, then it makes, we're a generous society, we'll put money towards trying to make sure that as many people can get access to that as possible. It's an intuitive response on behalf of a grassroots response rather than through our representatives in government. The thing about philanthropy is that it's typically focused on the memory of particular individuals. That's a very strong driver for philanthropy. And in that sense, people have different priorities. So somebody might have a priority for breast cancer because their sister died of breast cancer. Another person might have a priority on brain tumors and so forth. And there are more than 200 different cancer types. So you can see that there's investment across the full spectrum of cancer types. But as to investment that can reach the scale of everybody for all things, that's much harder to achieve. I guess the value of our program is that we are agnostic to the cancer type. We don't care where the cancer began, what it looks like under the light microscope. Once it's become something that's incurable, we want to help that patient and find a treatment through molecular profiling. And in that sense, maybe we become a focal point for people that want to see change for their constituency, knowing that we will cover their constituency and others. And I think Sam Johnson in particular has had an incredible impact for us, because Sam's taken the view that he wants to particularly support people in the bush who are doing it tough anyway and who have worse survival from cancer than our city brothers and sisters. So he wants to make sure that these advances that we're introducing into clinical care through our research programs, that they don't just get confined to the big smoke and the big institutions, the ivory towers, that they're accessible out where patients are living in the bush as well. And that's been an incredible partnership with Love Your Sister. They've essentially allowed us to reach 36% of the patients coming into our program now come from outside metropolitan areas. And that's, I think, squarely down to Love Your Sister's support.
Yeah, good on you, Sam. He's out there doing it every day tirelessly, isn't he? Let's talk about Omico.
Yeah.
This is your precision oncology platform. So you've profiled more than 15,000 Australians that are obviously already advanced with cancer.
Yes.
That's how they become a part of your program?
Yeah. So once a person becomes incurable or is at high risk of becoming incurable, sometimes people don't have the time to wait for the results of the test if we leave it a bit later than that. So we're now, as soon as they become incurable, those patients are eligible to take part in a program. It's no cost to them. It's a research study. People sign consents to take part. They're fully briefed and informed. Then we organise the molecular profiling, and it doesn't involve travel. It can be done. The consents can be done remotely from anywhere in the country. We have patients literally from every corner of this country coming onto our programs. And once we get the results of the molecular test, we do the magic of connecting that particular unique fingerprint of a molecular signature to treatments. And treatments primarily through clinical trials that are going on around the country. At that point, people sometimes have to travel to be able to take part in a trial because they're only open at specific centres, for example. And that may mean that people have to travel. And we don't have enough trials available. We need more trials. And ultimately, we need those drugs to become part of the PBS so that they're available to every patient, no matter where they are, to every clinician in every corner of the country as well. So people don't have to travel for these sorts of treatments. But yes, that's what we're doing. And we've done it for more than 15,000 patients. We've made treatment recommendations in 70% of the patients that we've screened. And as I said, about 37% of those patients have got a drug target, which we know will extend survival.
A quick pause in today's episode to share some of my must-try products at youmusttryit.com. Through the Aging Project, I've learned managing stress is something to be intentional about, which is why over at youmusttryit.com, we've created a stress and sleep page with all of our favorite products. After today's episode, go check out the Shakti Mat. This is an acupressure mat with over 6,000 spikes. Yes, I swear by it, as do so many of our customers. Even previous guest, Dr. Peter Wright from the Vera Wellness Clinic said, "I love this mat, Shelley. Thank you. It is my pleasure, Dr. Peter." To grab yours, just go to youmusttryit.com and type Shakti. That's S-H-A-K-T-I. You'll also find essential oils, supplements, and organic teas, all designed to reduce stress and aid sleep. Trust me, all are a must try. Just go to youmusttryit.com for a 10% discount off your first order and to join our community. Incredible. Absolutely incredible work that you're doing.
Thank you.
We here at the Aging Project, we are connected to FitGenes, which is a basic little cheek swab, and you send that away and we profile some more of your wellness and lifestyle genes, I suppose, the ones that you can make small changes in your own daily routine or the way that you eat or exercise that are going to have a positive effect on your longevity.
Right.
Is there the opportunity that one day something as simple as that is available to all of us, which will show what we're more susceptible to, what we're likely of, what our genetic profile is, so that we can also put things into place to avoid ever having to come to see someone like you?
I'm not offended. I agree. That's the goal, to pick these things up early so that they're curable and it can be gotten out of the way and people can go on and live long and healthy lives. Treating people at the end of the cancer journey is not where we need to be. We need to be treating people early as possible and also ultimately maybe even prevent cancers through treatments that may stop the cancer before it starts. So the short answer to your question is yes, that is going to happen. We already know that it is possible, and some of our own work shows that it is possible. For example, of those 15,000 patients who come in for tumor profiling, that is, we take a bit of their tumor, we molecularly profile it, we can see the genes that we inherit, we can see those changes present even within the tumor.
Phenomenal.
Excuse me for a moment while I'm just correcting my background. What that means is that in about 1 in 12 people of those 15,000, more than 1,000 of those individuals, we've found the reason why they developed the cancer in the first place. Now, that's a bit late because they've obviously got advanced cancer. But remember, they share their genes with 1 in 2 first-degree relatives. And therefore, we create, through the profiling of individual patients, potential benefit for their family members, their daughters and sons, their sisters and brothers, potentially their parents as well, so that they can then be offered personalized risk management that may identify their cancer at a curable stage. So that's one area where we're definitely beginning to identify patients that we would never have understood before, never have known about before, through molecular profiling of the tumor. But we can now do those sort of tests on a blood sample or on a cheek swab, as you describe it. And that technology, our data suggests that about 1 in 5 of the patients who get diagnosed with cancer today has something in their genetic makeup that explains their cancer or could be used to improve their survivorship after the cancer is treated and cured, hopefully. That might influence whether their risk of second cancers, but also the risk of other diseases and their risk of adverse reactions to drugs that they may get exposed to over the remainder of their life. That genetic makeup information has enormous power potentially to improve health maintenance, maintaining us in a healthy state as we age. And yes, I think that's a very realistic vision that you have.
Oh, it makes me very emotional because I feel like we're on the precipice, aren't we? We are on the brink of this. And if we start with the people that have access to you that obviously are in an advanced or have rare cancers, but then their families are allowed access to this as well. So then we're sort of the next chain down. And then for the people, if we work our way out, it doesn't seem impossible. It seems, as I said in the beginning, incredibly hopeful, which might be a naive way to think of this. But it's extraordinary that in our lifetime, at least we can do something actionable about this. You say cancer's, you know, the treatments have been around for 170 plus years, cancer's been around forever, and yet now there is this incredible hope, and it seems there's so many fabulous people like yourself, David, working towards something for all of us. And again, I can't thank you enough for that. You're making me all teary now because it seems so close. And we learn a little bit here on the Aging Project about so many things. We've spoken to professors about bowel cancer. We've spoken to professors in individual, you know, breast cancer situations. This seems like it can change the world for everybody. That blueprint, as you say, for a cancer-free future is very, very close.
Yeah, and knowledge, the pace of knowledge generation is accelerating. It's not as if it's been steady over the past, say, 50 years. It's actually going up with the power of computers and robotics and amazing things like artificial intelligence now are accelerating our ability to see a vulnerability and then exploit it within a reasonable time frame rather than on the never never for the next generation of patients. We can actually apply these sorts of technologies, this sort of knowledge generation, research, clinical trials to patients today to benefit the patient in front of us today rather than for somebody in the future, which I think means that our healthcare system has to change in another way, doesn't it? Because the way we think about healthcare is, you know, it's proven, it's established, that's what we do, we've got evidence for it. But we're in a situation where sometimes the evidence is emerging. It's got a little bit of uncertainty about it, but it's still a damn sight better than doing nothing about a cancer that's going to take your life. And therefore, research has to be regarded as, I think, rather than something that is outside the healthcare system, it has to be part of the healthcare system. And that is also a pretty big change from healthcare point of view, from how governments invest.
I think too we're very forceful here, I think, with our community about looking after your own health and not leaving it just to that 15-minute GP appointment that you've had through your youth, but now it's a lot more serious. You have to take your health more seriously and take control of that. Things like full-body MRIs that are now becoming more readily available to the general public. Yeah. Is that something that you think we should be doing to catch it before it takes hold, to keep us in the clear, I guess to give us peace of mind that, you know, between the year that we have it, that we're in the clear?
Well, you have to be careful what you wish for is the short answer to that. So you mentioned whole body MRI. So we've been studying whole body MRI for more than a decade now. And where we started with it was in patients who have a super high risk of cancer. There's a condition called Lee Frameni syndrome. It's been known about for more than 50 years. And the genetic cause of it's been known for 30 years, but we've had nothing we could do about it really until maybe 5 years ago when we and others did research using whole body MRI, which showed that we could pick up cancers silently in these patients with Lee Frameni syndrome and therefore remove them with curative intent. The average survival of the Lee Frameni population is something like 40 years of age. They die at age 40 because of 50% of them get cancers by the age of 30. And of course, ultimately, some of those cancers are going to become lethal and kill the patient. So picking these things up early is really critical. And whole body MRI was really important for that population because the cancers to which those patients are prone can occur anywhere in the body. So you couldn't just image the breast or image the bowel and detect the cancers that were going to be lethal. You had to take a broader approach, and that's where whole body MRI came in. But if your question is, should we be offering whole body MRI to everybody, say at age 50? Well, that That the problem with that is that about one in 10 people that we screen with whole body MRI at the age of 50 will have something going on. And sometimes it's a cancer, which is great because you can do something about it potentially. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's not. And if you screen, let's say, every person at the age of 50, same thing we do with bowel screening, for example, or breast screening, then we're talking about tens of thousands of people getting a whole body MRI. And mm-hmm. if 10%, that means thousands of people will be having subsequent investigations. And then the harm that can be caused by investigating something that would never have been a problem if we hadn't picked it up becomes an issue. And that's something that we need to think about. It's the reason we started with Li-Fraumeni syndrome is that the risk-benefit ratio is so much more in favor of the patient when they know they've got a very high risk of cancer than if you've got mm-hmm. a background risk of cancer and finding something. But that's just the beginning. We did those studies, which have changed clinical practice, only in 2017. We published those papers. And now whole body MRI is part of routine care on the MBS, thanks to Omico's application to the government to make this a standard of care. Mm-hmm. It's conceivable that by 2030, we'll be expanding whole body MRI to other conditions which are associated with increased cancer risk. And as we mm-hmm. spread it out, it'll get to the point where potentially things like age might be a criterion where you say, over the age of 60, we know that cancer is a disease of aging. Therefore, if we do the MRI, we're probably going to pick up things like a calcium score in the heart. We might pick mm-hmm. up people who are at risk of cancer more generally. But there's a lot of evidence to generate to make sure we don't do more harm than good by that approach. And but I guess it's better than having no options. We have reasonable questions to ask that we can test going forward that are aiming at what you just described.
It just seems, yes, again, we're sort of in this weird patch at the moment, isn't it? We've got enough information, we're getting more information, we don't need too much information because the system isn't set up to deal with that yet. So it really is those two steps forward, one step back in this situation. I guess the joy that we get out of today's conversation that there is options and there is that idea that cancers are becoming more and more curable every day. And so you just have to go in there, I guess, with the mindset that you are going to be one of those ones that will be a survivor and live to tell the tale. And you've got some incredible stories. Would you mind sharing a patient story with us, if you can, of someone that has come through your program and had success?
Sure. Well, one that springs to mind as a sarcoma specialist is a young man called Matthew, who I won't mention any other details for confidentiality reasons. But Matthew came onto the program, and he's actually spoken about this in public, so I'm sure he won't mind me using his example anonymously. He came onto the program at the age of 28 with an unresectable, incurable sarcoma affecting his spine. Sarcomas are not good diseases to have. Drugs don't tend to work in them. They're rare, so management is always tough to begin with. But this had become incurable. And we did molecular profiling on his tumor and identified a drug target, an immunotherapy drug target, which we didn't expect. Immunotherapies don't generally work in sarcomas. But his tumor had a particular biomarker that predicted response to immunotherapy called tumor mutation burden. And so he went onto a trial of the immunotherapy, and he had not merely shrinkage, but his tumors disappeared as far as we could tell. So he was 28 and looking at a shortened lifespan. And the thing I love about this story is that Matthew not only had his tumors shrink and disappear, he was able to stop treatment. The tumors have not come back. And he then got married and he had his first child, actually.
Oh, David.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it doesn't happen for everybody, Shelley. I want to make that clear. But yeah, it would have happened for nobody 20 years ago. It's now mm-hmm. happening for about one in three patients that we're making a difference. And by, say, the next 10 years, there's no reason why we shouldn't expect more than half of all the patients we're profiling to have a biomarker, as we call it, that will predict response to an increasing range of drugs that are coming down the pike. That's what science is doing. It's raising possibilities. But we need one thing that we need to solve is how we get this stuff from science and through available through clinical trials to making it a routine part of the PBS and the testing part of the MBS. And I think the time has passed when that is an issue that we need to address. It's not a scientific question. It's a social and political question, a health economic question perhaps, but it isn't a question of the science anymore. The science, I think, has crossed a Rubicon about 4 or 5 years ago now, where the benefits from these approaches are, I don't think they're debatable anymore from a clinical perspective.
What can we do for you, Professor? Is there anything that our community and our wider listeners can do to help you make this happen in our healthcare system?
Well, that's a lovely offer. And yes, there is an enormous amount. So as a clinician and as a scientist, As I've said, I think the evidence is right there in front of me about the ability to change things. But the question about whether a government decides to mainstream the science that's emerging is, at least the timing of it, is dependent on political will. And I don't mean that in the sort of pejorative sense of politics being somehow a nasty business. I mean that our representatives in government need to understand that every household in this country is affected by cancer, and it is a priority for every household that the best possible approaches to treatment are available. Once it becomes a political priority, then the sums of money that we're talking about for making a difference here are quite feasible within the context, for example, of the $130 billion that we committed towards JobKeeper when, within a few weeks of COVID hitting our shores. And science solved COVID through vaccination strategies so that we're now living a life that's now freed up as a consequence of the investment in tackling what was seen to be a new problem. I think we need to get out of the mindset that cancer is something that we just have to put up with. We can't do anything about. There were 8 times as many people who died of cancer over the period of COVID as died from COVID. If you think about taking even 10% of that investment in COVID, say $13 billion, not $130, or even $1 billion, you could completely transform the sort of area that we're talking about. So governments are capable of making those investments if they see it as a priority. The thing that your program can do, your listeners can do, is to make sure that the government understands that they and their families want this. They want our taxes to go towards mainstreaming the science in the area of oncology because it works. And it shouldn't just be accessible to the lucky few who can access a research program. It should be something that you can access as part of routine care, at least the best of it. And I think, therefore, the problem is no longer mine in the sense of generating the evidence and the science. It's a question of the advocacy from the community that this is something that's a priority for our society. And yes, I think, therefore, you've got a very important role to play in advocating for this to be routine care.
We will do our best to get the word out there. I guess, yes, it seems like a tough mission ahead for that to change. But if everyone, as you say, every household in Australia, every household in the world is affected by this, it seems crazy that it isn't the top priority of our governments and of our healthcare system. We have screenings, obviously. We can, send out for a bowel cancer screening. We can go for a breast screening. And again, I appreciate in this country that that is readily available to us. Lung screenings are available. The fact that it's not making the cut through that it should is really what concerns me when you were talking the numbers that you've spoken about today. If anyone, and I know everyone will, like to learn more about Professor David's work, please jump on to omico.com.au. You can sign up there for a newsletter to follow everything that's been going on. We ask you, I guess, to take the best care you can of yourself. Professor, do you have any advice, what we could be doing in our everyday lives, again, as I said, to not end up sitting in front of you. What do you do to keep yourself fit, healthy, strong, clean?
Well, I think looking after yourself, being active is incredibly important, eating well, going and seeing your GP regularly for checkups. As it happens, I have metastatic cancer myself. It doesn't really matter in some ways how well you look after yourself. As I said, this is a scourge that's affected us for all of human history. And, a very high fraction of our community will develop cancer no matter what they do. But we can pick it up early. We can know when we're at increased risk, so we can pay particular attention to some people, put our efforts towards keeping them as safe as we possibly can because they are at risk. And we can make sure that the treatments that we have if cancer develops are the best possible so that we have the best possible chance of curing that person once it is diagnosed. And I think because it's so common, there's a question about community screening, and you've mentioned some programs that do it. I think the future in that space is quite bright with blood tests coming along, for example, in addition to things like whole body MRI. And those sorts of technologies may well create in the future perhaps something like a cholesterol test for cancer. You know, we use cholesterol tests to guide the use of lipid lowering strategies, drugs that we can use that delay us developing a heart attack or a stroke. Well, in the future, perhaps there'll be a blood test that identifies cancer that makes it much easier to know who's at risk and who isn't. That's completely credible, and it will all come through science and research.
Professor, I hope we're speaking to you again in a very short time, whether that be a year or two, with dramatic changes that have come forward. Seems this space is moving forward in leaps and bounds, again, thanks to you and your peers. So I'll thank you one more time. I'll ask everyone to look up Omico, to get on board and to look for ways that they can make a louder noise to our leaders to hopefully make this come to fruition sooner rather than later. Thanks again.
Thank you, Shelley. Thanks for your time.
What an incredible man and what a really powerful conversation that was. Cancer is a word that carries so much fear, but today Professor David Thomas reminded us of something that is just as powerful, and that is hope. We're living in a time where science can read the blueprint of a tumour, match it to a treatment, and offer options that didn't exist just a decade ago. And thanks to leaders like David, this isn't just a dream for the future. It's already happening for thousands of people. So here's the takeaway I want you to remember. Cancer is not one disease, and it's not one size fits all. The future of cancer care is personal, it's precise, and it's within our reach if we just keep pushing, funding, and demanding that every patient has access. So what can you do? Well, don't wait until symptoms. Take prevention and screening very seriously. And most of all, remember that knowledge is power. The more you understand your body, your risks, and your options, the stronger you become. Together, as Professor Thomas said, there's no time to waste and no lives to lose. Thank you so much for joining us today. If this conversation moved you, share it with someone you love, because the more we talk about cancer openly, the closer we get to changing its story. Until next time, let's keep learning, let's keep talking, and let's keep building a healthier future together. I'm Shelley Craft. I'll speak to you soon. As always, the Aging Project podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. Always seek medical advice from a qualified practitioner.